This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The hashtag MeToo movement has broken a decades-long culture of silence around sexual assault and harassment and taken down a number of powerful men. Since the story broke about Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, more than 40 men have been fired or forced to resign because of sexual misconduct. That's according to the New York Times. So what's the tie that binds together each of these individual incidents? My guest today argues it is a culture of power and privilege held together by toxic masculinity. Rob Okun is the editor of Voicemail. It's a magazine that's been chronicling the social transformation of masculinity for more than three decades. The book Voicemail, The Untold Story of Pro-Feminist Men's Movement, compiles selected essays from the magazine, and Rob Okun is with me today to talk more about it. Rob, welcome.
Glad to be here, Frank.
Talk about the goals of this book, which really bring together, as we said, decades of essays on this very topic.
Yes. We're at a moment in the culture where the voices of men who believe in women's equality and believe in the safety of women and girls has to be heard. And it looks like that's starting to happen, but what's the untold story is what's often referred to as one of the most important social justice movements you've never heard of. And what I mean is that men have been doing this work since the 1970s. They followed the leadership and the inspiration and the incredible energy that women brought to the women's movement and learned from it. But in every decade since the late 70s, men have been engaged in this work. And it's time that the men who are on the sidelines not necessarily become full-time activists, but are willing to use their voices on behalf of their mothers, their sisters, their wives, their partners, their daughters, and to speak up, because the culture of what you're calling toxic masculinity is just, it's unacceptable. And we see it permeating so many areas of our life. What's also important to think about is that it's not just the famous and the well-known who are perpetrating these behaviors. We don't know the stories of what happened in classrooms in small towns across the country. We don't know what's happened in medical facilities, in factories, in office buildings. So what's being sussed out here is that men have taken advantage of these two words, privilege and entitlement. Just because we arrived on the planet in male-identified bodies does not give us any extra reason to be in charge or operating a patriarchal system.
Tell us more about the history of this movement, though, and men's engagement in this, because it's always a tricky business when you are considered part of the problem to say, well, we would like to engage. How do we do that?
Right. Well, a lot of men looked on with excitement, nervousness, envy, suspicion when women started having consciousness-raising groups in the 60s, getting together, meeting at night. No, honey, I won't be making dinner. I'm going to my group. You can fend for yourself. What? That's not okay. And men having to kind of pick themselves up and dust themselves off and ask themselves some hard questions. Too many men were not really paying attention to the experience of women's oppression, just like they weren't paying attention to the oppression of any minority group, because just like fish don't see the water in which they swim, men just took for granted their privilege in the home and in the workplace and everywhere. And it was only when a few and then a growing number of men started to pay attention and ask themselves some questions about what they were listening to women say and having to believe, recognize that, yeah, what they're saying is true. The playing field is unequal. Women are given the shaft. It's not fair. And I may not want to do more domestic chores. I may not want to cook dinner or take care of the kids more. And I'm not a babysitter, I'm a co-parent, and that's a whole other discussion about fathering. But slowly, some men started to listen. And when they asked women what they could do, how they could help, the first area that women were interested in was stop the violence against women, domestic violence and sexual violence. You know, Gloria Steinem famously said, women want a men's movement. We're literally dying for it. And the first groups that started in the late 70s and into the 80s and the beginning of batterers intervention groups where men were leading groups for men who've been abusive, those first men's pro-feminist, anti-sexist men's groups focused in on the violence issue because that's what women were asking us to pay attention to. And you could ask, well, what about women's reproductive rights, which are under attack, or the economic disparity where women are earning 79 cents of a dollar on the dollar? But that was the first pressing issue was, you know, stop seeing women get killed.
Not only was stop the violence the first issue, but you were also saying something there inherently was that it would be men talking to men in this case.
Exactly. In fact, for some of us, that was an uncomfortable moment because who we were comfortable talking with about emotional issues and things going on in our intimate lives and looking around into our interior lives were women. Not necessarily romantic partners, but often that was the mainstay. But we felt more comfortable talking with women about these kinds of issues. And there was some pushback, sometimes gentle and sometimes a little more compelling from women. You guys go over there and figure it out. You guys talk right. amongst yourselves.
The talking amongst yourself part, though, becomes challenging for a number of reasons. But I would think one is to sell the idea that the feminist movement is for everybody and not just for women.
Yes, and that is for some men, maybe all men in the beginning until they have their wake up moment, their aha moment. Because at the face of it, giving up privilege means, hey, you know, I'm the older kid and I used to go to bed at 9 and my brother or sister went at 8 and now they want the same privilege. Well, in the terms of men and masculinity, giving up the privilege also means opening up your world. So if women are feeling more empowered, if women are feeling happier in their work life, in their home life, because you're sharing things, then they're happier and there isn't that tension. And you have an opportunity to cultivate parts of yourself that you heretofore hadn't been paying much attention to, or living in a culture that hasn't necessarily been inviting you to cultivate those aspects.
Yeah, but the counter to that argument is, no, I don't have any privilege. I work very hard for what I got. You can go to school. I can go to school. You can get an education, get a job. I can get an education. I don't have any privilege. And B, if you're unhappy, stop reading those books and, you know, get down to your job. Do what you're supposed to do.
Well, what women, quote unquote, were supposed to do were two jobs. Were go to work and we live in an economy where we need to have both partners wage earners, whether it's in a heterosexual or a gay relationship. We need both people working. And in the case of women, the expectation, both social and familial, were that when you got home, you'd be the one who would be preparing dinner. You'd be the one who'd be getting the kids' lunches ready. And I think the pushback for men has been, well, why is that? Just because that's how granddad and maybe dad did it? Well, that's not a good enough reason. And I think that we're noticing if we just take from women got the right to vote, the suffrage movement from 1920 on. If we just look at this last 100 years, the march of progress for women has been phenomenal. And simultaneous truth, we find ourselves having ripped this terrible wound open that's been exposing just how women have been treated in many of the work world avenues. And it's just been shaking things up from top to bottom, from the halls of Congress and the 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue right to the voters in Alabama last night.
Now, we're talking about the new edition of this book that compiles 30 years of essays in Voicemail magazine. And the new edition out has essays around various themes. Let's tackle a few of those themes one at a time. Let's start with the connection between gun culture and masculinity.
Right. So there's a lot of men who hunt and use guns appropriately and feel that, you know, that's a rite of passage. It certainly is for people in environments where they can get out into the woods, and that's fine. What's missing in our conversation and in some of the writing that I've done and others have done is the relationship between gun violence, like the Las Vegas shootings, for example. I mean, they're happening so frequently that it's hard to keep up with them. But we never look at the issue of the gender of the shooter. So I have probably written 15, 20 variations on the same op-ed, whether it was, you know, the Orlando shooting or the Las Vegas shooting, going all the way back to Columbine in 1998 in Colorado, where talking about the mental health of the shooter, talking about gun control, it's like a two legs of a three-legged stool, and no one is talking about the gender of the shooter. And if we really want to disassemble and deconstruct this male gun violence and these disaffected men who were the 99.9% of the perpetrators of these mass shootings, then we need to look at how we're raising boys.
Talk about that. You say that the way we socialize boys and cultivate their emotional intelligence is something that you think should be a national priority. We should take a look at this as a public health issue.
Absolutely. And I think that would be a refreshing sea change that Congress could take a look at. I've spoken with an aide to Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, who's interested in these issues, about the idea of the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, beginning a nationwide study of how we socialize, say, 3-, 4-, 5-year-olds. They're already plugged in. They could start with Head Start kids if they wanted. They could figure out how to do this and provide the funding. So we look at the messages that we're giving to little boys. And there's no reason that we can't be cultivating their capacity to be nurturing, to be compassionate. Those words have tended to be gendered feminine, just like, you know, bravery and courage have tended to be gendered male, masculine, which is absurd because we're human beings, you know, and that should be our goal, is to be developing healthy human beings. But because of the way that boys have been socialized to repress their feelings, happily, I've witnessed over the arc of being a parent and now a grandparent, the change from a little boy falling down and the message coming back to him, big boys don't cry, to come here, honey, let me hold you and comfort you until you feel better. I've witnessed that and I've seen that. And I know that, you know, that's how my sons-in-law are raising their children, two boys and a girl and a boy in those cases. So it's happening. The shift is happening. But we live in a culture and we live in the messages from pop music and from media often are making it hard for us to push against the river.
But anytime you talk about pop culture, you're talking about, in a sense, a market. And that market is catering to some kind of pre-existing sort of easy money. In other words, we are predisposed to believe that stuff. Pop culture isn't going to push against anything to make a buck. And so the suggestion is there's something even deeper than that, that is the real trough, right, that's drawing this stream of toxic masculinity. You know, what's that? And do these conversations get at that, or are we treating one symptom at a time and still neglecting some of the underlying trouble?
Well, if we start from the premise that conventional masculinity, that most of the traditional ways that males are socialized to act in the culture, if we start from the premise that it's not working, that we're seeing right now, if we just look at this one huge epidemic of sexual harassment and sexual violence as part of this disease that men are infected with, then we can actually begin to have the conversation of, okay, we need to try something different. And if we've spent decades creating a pop culture that doesn't recognize compassionate caring, you know, bromance, the bromance movies became kind of a thing for a while, or these buddy movies. And there's chipping away. I mean, we've got a big job ahead of us in beginning this shift, but there's this term, the Great Turning, that there is this transformation of culture and the society, and that things are heading in a better direction. I tended to think of the shock of seeing someone as unqualified as Donald Trump becoming president, let alone any of the other things that we could talk about, just on qualifications alone, no foreign policy experience, no government experience, no real leadership experience other than, being an autocrat inside of a family dynasty.
There were the four bankruptcies in his business, so there is some leadership there.
Well said. So just if you start with that place alone, you can see that, this isn't working. So we need to be looking at something else. And the other complicating factor that we're dealing with in our culture is that a lot of the men and a lot of white men have been left out of the conversation for a long time.
Woody, I think you probably answered this, but again, there's two real ways of looking at this. One is what you said. I mean, Donald Trump, who has acknowledged doing things that in many states would be considered a felony.
Should be in all states.
In all states, has acknowledged that. And so we see this kind of behavior at the top. We saw a close election just now in Alabama with an accused child molester coming within 20,000 votes of becoming a senator of the United States. How do you read that? I mean, is the fact that Donald Trump didn't get a majority, the fact that he only has 38% approval, 38% of the voting public is 65 million people. How do you read that? Are we nowhere near where we should be, or are we making progress, and are we at a turning point?
Yes, I think we are making progress. And when I watched the documentary that Michael Moore made, Donald Trump, Michael Moore in Trumpland, that came out a month before the election, he had this moment where he was parroting how men at Trump rallies were bellowing, and he was roaring and he said these loud guttural sounds. He said it reminded me of dinosaurs, and we're at the end of that era where the men, as he put it, we've had a good run, guys, 10,000 years.
Well, I want you to – this is my last question, so I want to give you time for this because it does seem that there's a paradox. If on the one hand we call it toxic masculinity and we say it should be treated as a public health problem, on the other hand, what we're protecting is male privilege, it does sound like it's working. It does give us something. What's the harm to men through male toxic – what's toxic about this and how does it hurt men?
Well, look at the health statistics of our increase in heart disease, in our shorter life expectancy, in our levels of depression, in our rates of suicide. Men aren't happy. And the happier, the more that men identify with feminism and women's equality, the studies are there, the happier they become. If I can, I'd like to just read a few lines from mm-hmm. the book. This is at the afterword of the book. In contemplating the next steps for pro-feminist men, I've come to a new understanding of why a female president wasn't elected in 2016 and why there was a backlash in a rise in mean spirit and angry male behavior. Sometimes before a species goes extinct, it has a last gasp, a final burst of energy. I believe history will record this era as both patriarchy's last stand and feminism's next chapter.
Rob Okun, editor and publisher of Voicemail magazine, also edited the book Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Rob, thank you so much for talking with us. And you're going to be at Quail Ridge Books tonight at, in fact, we've got the details, but you're going to be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh.
At 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock tonight. We've got the details at our website. Good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Just ahead, a new book sets Arthurian legends in the far-off future. Stay with us on The State of Things.